This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people. Hello and welcome back to the MDT. I am Jo Preston.
And I am Ian Wilkinson. And today we are on our fifth episode of the second series. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be talking about urinary tract infections.
A bugbear for everyone.
Bugbear for everyone.
As with every episode, we have a faculty contributing. This time we have Dr. Amy Heskett, who's a community geriatrician. We have Claire Watson, who is a practice development nurse. Adam Buckler, a pharmacist. And Gabor CK, who's a GP.
The MDT Podcast.
So we've got some feedback following the last episode, a few different things. So firstly, we've got Shayna Hanlon, who pointed out to us that we weren't on TuneIn Radio, but now we are. So now he can listen through his Alexa Amazon Echo, which scares me slightly. But if you use TuneIn Radio, then you can find us on there now. We also had a tweet from Kenneth Rockwood in response to our frailty episode. If you remember back, he is one of the people that came up with one of the theories of frailty. And he pointed out that if we all lived long enough, we all would probably end up displaying some signs of frailty at some point. So that's worth bearing in mind listening to that episode. We also had some nice resources shared with us by Karen Goody, who was from the Scottish Delirium Association. So we've put those on our website. So if you've got any resources that you think would be useful following any of the episodes that you've listened to, then do let us know and we'll board them into the website and share them with all of our listeners. And you can find those at www.thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk. There's a nice video that we've shared by Frailty Fulcrum. Fusion 48. It's a nice introduction to the idea of a kind of life balance for people with frailty of lots of different factors, not just the physical elements. So go and have a look at that video. It's nice to share with people perhaps who don't work inside hospitals or aren't medics. And we had some really nice feedback. I really like this from the renal team in Brighton, who stopped one of the geriatricians, Tom Hutchinson, who's at Geriatric Giant on Twitter. It's a great Twitter name. Who said that actually lots of their after-action reviews and their kind of safety review system are to do with frail older adults, and that they were going to start thinking about using this podcast as some education to learn and improve the care for older people at Brighton. So that's great news.
The MDT Podcast.
We're going to kick off this episode, as we do with each episode, with some feedback from our MDT. On their experiences of urinary tract infections.
Oh, hello, my name's Alison. I'm a nurse working with the OPAL team at St George's Hospital. When I'm told or we're querying if someone's got a urine infection, I tend to think immediately, has anyone tested the urine? What's that shown if it has been tested? If they've had urine infections before, if they're drinking, their hygiene, all those sorts of things sort of contribute to it. And then if it's been tested, what's it shown, whether it should actually be sent off for further investigation rather than just starting them on antibiotics. And is it symptomatic, in which case it may need treatment. If it's not, it might not. And if it's actually impacting on the patient and their day-to-day life and how they're managing with it, i.e. either having to run to the toilet or wear pads or something like that.
Hi, I'm Owen. I'm one of the doctors working on the elderly care ward. I suppose for me, the first thing to say about urinary tract infections, I'm always a little bit dubious about a diagnosis of a urinary tract infection. Now, they are very common, particularly in elderly patients, so we do see a lot of them. But there's also lots of people that we see that have been diagnosed with urinary tract infections that possibly don't have a urinary tract infection. It's not the only diagnosis in elderly care. In fact, I would say a good proportion of the patients we see with a UTI actually have another more complicated medical problem. But that doesn't mean they're not important. Urinary tract infections in the patients that we look after present with lots of different problems. They can be very, very septic and extremely unwell and possibly even need intensive care. Or they can be acutely confused and difficult to manage with their behaviours despite not looking too septic from their blood tests and their parameters. The key message on urinary tract infections is if patients change, you need to think there's a possibility of urinary tract infection and get a good urine dipstick and ideally an MSU. But you also need to take it in context with what else is going on and not just treat every single urine dipstick you get.
So you can see that it affects people in different ways and really is something, means something to every member of our MDT. And often confusion is the thing that people talk about.
Yeah.
But this week we're going to talk about...
their own and the patient's.
Yes. So this week we're going to talk about how to manage and diagnose urinary tract infections.
In particular, the diagnosis bit we are really going to focus on, because I think it's something that people really, really struggle with. It's hugely overdiagnosed, I think, because it's difficult to diagnose. So it's easy to say, oh, well, it's probably a urinary tract infection because we can't quite prove it. But we're going to talk through some things that are going to help you to really distinguish whether this is or isn't a urinary tract infection with your patient.
And I'm going to try and not get too ranty, because
don't promise things you can't deliver.
And it does lead to inappropriate antibiotic prescribing, which leads to far too many antibiotics, which leads to C. diff, which leads to all sorts of horrendous badness that we're hopefully going to avoid by getting the diagnosis right at the start.
Also, it avoids the person getting the correct diagnosis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's really important. So, okay, what is a UTI?
So it is an infection of the urinary tract somewhere between the kidney and the urethra.
Yes, via the bladder.
Via the bladder, yes.
And something you hear of quite often is recurrent urinary tract infections. Mm. And that's defined as 3 episodes of urinary tract infection in the previous 12 months or 2 episodes in the last 6 months.
Yes, and that is dependent on you having the diagnosis of each individual urinary tract infection correct.
Yes.
So if somebody has overactive bladder and urinary frequency and has occasional episodes of incontinence, they may never have had a urinary tract infection.
Or they were just given a course of antibiotics for a urinary tract infection. Yes. Doesn't define it.
But it is probably common.
But we said we wouldn't rant.
Yes.
And there we are already.
Yes. Okay. About a quarter of all hospital-acquired infections are urinary tract infections. And I think from a practical point of view, it's probably better to have a think about not only what urinary tract infections are, but what they're not.
Yes. So I like a talk that I was at by Sean Ninan, who is on Twitter, says it is not an acute trimethoprim deficiency.
Yeah. And
I really like that.
At Sean 9N. Yeah. And it's not the root source of all confusion query cause.
Yes.
That is, of course, delirium. It is a cause of delirium, but it is not the cause of all delirium. So go back to episode 2 in series 1. If that doesn't make sense.
Nor is it proven or diagnosed by a positive dipstick by itself. And we're going to talk a lot more about that later, so let's just leave that there. So what usually comes with it? Let's start with symptoms.
Yeah.
It's a good place to start generally. The usual things that we all know about that affect older adults in the same way, younger adults, things like dysuria, so burning when they pass urine, urinary frequency or cystitis, blood or pus in the urine, feeling that you haven't quite emptied your bladder, getting lower abdominal pain, and that can be anywhere from the loin to the groin in pyelonephritis.
Yes.
It tends to be suprapubic in just a simple UTI.
Yeah, and in pyelonephritis, which is infection or literally pus around the kidney, is really, really sore.
So things that we are more likely to see in the older age group are things like new incontinence, that wasn't there before, new overactive bladder symptoms where they weren't there before, so this isn't just purely overactive bladder, and that's because the infection irritates the lining of the bladder.
So back in the first series, in episode 3, we talked about the management of continence and some of the overactive bladder symptoms.
Yeah.
You can also get non-specific symptoms.
Yeah, and this is the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, because they can be caused by any infection.
Yeah.
So things like delirium, reduced appetite, newly reduced mobility leading to falls,
nausea.
And it leads to a lot of overdiagnosis, really.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was just reading an article on the way up here looking at non-specific symptoms in nursing home residents from 2 large nursing home cohorts in the States and following them up to see which of the people that presented with just non-specific symptoms, you know, just not so well today, not eating today, such like, went on to have sort of serious illnesses. And it was interesting that it was more the negative symptoms, so the hypoactive symptoms.
Okay.
That were more likely to lead to serious illness, whereas the hyperactive symptoms, people being a little bit more agitated, such like, often were sort of a transient delirium went away.
Okay.
I thought it was just by the by.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And I think that's probably links into the under-recognition of that as a serious thing.
Yeah.
Kind of adds weight to that, doesn't it? So talking about nursing home residents, there are a set of criteria for diagnosing UTIs in people who are resident in nursing homes, specifically people without catheters, and that's been developed by the infectious disease consensus groups. And they've said that this is bacteria plus pyuria plus 2 out of dysuria, change in mental state, and change in the character of the urine.
So I think that's fine. So that's saying bacteria. So you've got to grow the urine and prove that there's bacteria there.
Yeah.
You've got to show that there's white cells there.
Yeah.
For pyuria, and then symptoms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that those symptoms may be non-specific, so change in mental state.
Delirium.
Delirium. And the reason that that exists is that the prevalence of asymptomatic bacteria in nursing home residents is quite high. It's about 50% of female nursing home residents.
So I think sometimes also just to think of that some patients don't have simple UTIs, and if someone's having recurrent UTIs, you need to think about whether or not they've got what's called a complicated UTI.
Mm.
More so because it's going to affect your antibiotic choice as well, I think.
Yeah, and also thinking about if there's a specific cause, if there's anything you can do about that cause.
Yeah.
So things like structural abnormalities, which is why you might do an ultrasound to have a look. Looking for things like cystocele or fistulae.
Yeah, if there's an iatrogenic cause, so if we've introduced a catheter.
Yeah, and if they've got voiding dysfunction, so if they're not completely emptying their bladder after they go to the toilet, then you've got a reservoir that can develop infection. And if you don't completely clear that each time, then you're going to be more prone to urinary tract infections.
And that's why post-void residual volumes of urine are really useful. And so the way to do that is you get someone to go to the toilet, they have a wee, and you lie them down, and straight afterwards you measure with the bladder scanner how much urine is left in the bladder. So it's important that they go to the loo first.
Yeah,
because it's no point scanning somebody's bladder just before they go to the loo, because all it says is they need to go to the loo.
Yeah, so it's a post-void.
Yes, you want to see how much is left afterwards.
Yes.
Yeah. And if someone's got more than 250, 300 mils residing in their bladder, they're at large risk of getting that infected.
Yes.
And that can be quite difficult to clear up unless you empty the bladder.
And manage. And the other voiding dysfunction that there is when there's high pressure and you get reflux back into ureters, and that can cause scarring
problems
long term. Yeah. There might be an obstruction, so there might be a stone sitting in the bladder. And then unless you treat that stone, it's going to be a focus for infection.
People might have diabetes and really sugary urine, which is obviously a haven for bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe immunosuppress themselves because of being on steroids or, you know, other immunosuppressive drugs.
Okay, so onto the big stuff, confirming the UTI.
Sounds simple, doesn't it?
I know.
How do you confirm a UTI?
By the end of this, it's going to be simple.
Yeah.
It's going to
be essentially,
fine.
So essentially, you've got to have the symptoms. And if you've got the classic set of symptoms...
That's usually enough.
It's usually enough.
Yeah.
If someone has recurrent sets of symptoms, the more episodes they have, the more investigations you need to do to find out why.
Yeah.
Urine dipsticks are only really useful for one thing.
Yes.
And that's ruling out a UTI.
Yes.
So a negative urine dipstick is useful.
Yeah.
A positive urine dipstick is kind of not useful, not unuseful.
Yeah.
It's just a thing.
So a totally negative urine dipstick correlates with negative microscopy, so the MSU actually coming back as being negative in 90 to 95% of people.
Yeah.
So it's a good negative predictive value.
Yeah.
But it has a false negative rate of around 5 to 10%. And this is in the kind of standard population. This isn't as useful in our older population. So we're going to talk through each bit of the dipstick now, which might sound a bit pedantic, but I think it's quite important to understand the dipstick to be able to interpret it. And given that we overinterpret them all the time, that's quite useful. So having leukocytes in the urine.
White blood cells.
White blood cells means there's a reaction to something happening there. So that has a good correlation with there being some pus cells in the microscopy. But you can have a false positive test if there's some contamination, so there's local bacteria there. So if you have fecal incontinence, or if you have atrophic vaginitis or TV or something like that, then actually you can be falsely positive just for that.
Yeah.
And actually it's nothing to do with your urine. It's just that your urine is kind of washing that into the sample.
Yeah.
However, sometimes you have false negatives with that as well. So if you've had recent antibiotics, you may not see leukocytes because they've been cleared up by those antibiotics, but actually you've still got some infection that's sitting there. It's just not enough to show up on that dipstick. Also, which I learnt doing the research this afternoon, didn't know before, you can have a falsely negative leukocytes if you've got a high glucose, a high protein, or a high specific gravity also on the dipstick. So that's
interesting.
Useful information.
And the blood on the dipstick is really super sensitive. So it is for dipping urine with. It's not for putting into vomits if someone's had hematemesis and stuff like that. It is to go in the urine.
Really? Do that.
I have.
That's another rant, and I think we should stop that there. We have plenty of rants of our own.
And
I think this might qualify for a nerd alert. So bacteria in the urine, particularly gram-negative bacteria, convert nitrates, which exist in the urine anyway, into nitrites, and that's what becomes positive on the urine dipstick.
And you have to wait for it to become positive. When you dip the test, you can't look at it straight away.
Yeah.
It's the last, almost the last one on your way round as you're reading it, so it needs a good minute.
Yeah.
Or, like, or whatever the thing says.
It's not ready
yet. You have to wait. Yes.
So positive nitrites is therefore a surrogate marker for bacteria in the urine. So a positive nitrites does suggest infection but doesn't confirm it, and has a negative predictive value. So if the nitrites are negative of anywhere between 25 and 70%, so that's a big range.
Yeah.
It's not really that helpful. It is 95% in the presence of symptoms, specific symptoms like dysuria. Frequency, those kinds of things, not non-specific symptoms. If you have non-specific symptoms, the usefulness of a positive dip sits at around 48% sensitivity, which to me is the same as flipping a coin. So you may as well just flip a coin.
So that when we say non-specific symptoms, that's generally confused, a bit more lethargic than normal.
Yeah.
Appetite change, that sort of thing.
There are some organisms which do cause urinary tract infections which will not give you the positive nitrites, and that's because they don't do that conversion. So positive doesn't, or a negative doesn't necessarily rule out either.
No. Yeah. But the gold standard test really is a midstream urine. It's called the MSU.
Send an MSU.
Yeah, and so that should be a sample of urine taken from the midpoint of the stream of urine.
Mm.
So that's tricky to get.
Yeah, and that's to try and get out those contaminants that are just kind of washing in.
And what they then do is they do a microscopy culture and sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
So they take it to the lab, they culture it, they look at it under the microscope, they then see what antibiotics would work if there is a specific culture of bacteria there. Mm. So it's not, you don't get an instant result. You know, it takes a little while to get a result from this.
Which is why you should just send it, I think.
Yeah.
You can do your dipstick to kind of guide you if you really must, and you really feel like you need to, and you think that from what we've just talked about, that it will be helpful in distinguishing one way or the other in the immediate term. But just send that MSU off before you've given any antibiotics so that you've got it.
Yep. And then blood tests looking for systemic infection. So a neutrophil count, so that's your full blood count. A CRP is normally raised with a urinary tract infection. And your ESR, if you're going to do it, is also normally raised. I think it's probably worth just saying that in institutional care, so in patients in long-term care homes, the frequency of positive urine dipsticks is very, very high because they may have other things causing that. So they may have a degree of proteinuria because they've got some renal disease, or they may have something else going on that's causing a slight leukocytosis in the bladder.
And also just being in institutionalised care environment, or say if you've been in and out of hospital, you've been exposed to lots of bugs, you're more likely to be colonised but not actually have active infection.
And up to 50% of elderly women in care homes have asymptomatic bacteria. So that's bacteria living in their bladder but not causing a systemic infection.
Yeah.
And indeed one study published back in 2001 showed that the negative predictive value of a urine dipstick, so that's dipping a urine and it being normal, was 100% for care home residents. So you've got, if you've got a negative dipstick in the context of somebody who's come in from a care home, essentially they don't have a UTI.
Mm. I never believe anything that's 100%, I'm not going to lie.
No,
but
exactly.
I think the point there is it's quite unusual.
Yeah.
So in combination with all of those other things, please look for another cause.
So we've thrown a lot of stats at you.
Yeah.
So I think what's useful at this point, if we go to the Silver Book, which is the British Geriatric Society's guidelines for the acute management of older people, and just go through two groups of patients. The first is where you're able to take a clear and unambiguous history from the patient. So they will either have no urinary symptoms, in which case don't do a urine dip, don't send an MSU, or they'll have new onset symptoms of frequency and dysuria, maybe with some abdominal pain or some hematuria or some change in smell or fever, another sign to go with it. And for those people, if you do the urine dipstick, if it's negative, be reassured, but find another cause for their symptoms.
The Silver Book says don't send an MSU. I'm quite tempted to send an MSU at that point because I think there's no harm.
No, I mean,
because
they're likely to re-dip it in the lab, aren't they?
Cook.
And they may not process it if it's completely negative. But
it takes a couple of days to come back. And if actually at the end of that couple of days you're still looking and that is the most likely source, then you'll have something to work from.
And then if it's positive for leukocytes and nitrites, it's likely they have a UTI. So send the MSU, but start antibiotics, particularly if they're septic.
Sepsis trumps everything. Yeah, so if you think someone has urosepsis, you just get on and treat. Yeah. But do send that MSU first, because once the antibiotics are in, it's going to be really difficult to interpret.
So the second group of patients are those people who you can't get a reliable, unambiguous history from.
Yeah. So the patient group that we're seeing the most often. Yeah.
So first of all, with those people, they say if there is new symptoms, so increased confusion, apathy, irritability or delirium.
So those non-specific symptoms. Yeah.
If they also have signs, so abdominal pain or hematuria, fever or offensive smelling urine, you've then kind of got a couple of choices. Again, a negative urine dipstick, be reassured, but find another cause for their symptoms. Mm-hmm. It's not a UTI. A positive dipstick, it's likely to be a UTI. And again, send an MSU. And if they need antibiotics at that point, give antibiotics or wait for your cultures first. Mm-hmm. And then if they've only got leukocytes, again, it may not be. You need to have a bit of a think at this point.
It's more likely to be colonisation rather than something causing an active infection, unless it's one of those bugs that don't cause nitrites.
Sepsis trumps all.
Yeah. And just to clarify with that there, it is those non-specific symptoms but with some specific signs.
If someone's having recurrent urinary tract infections and you grow something on the MSU and you've given them an antibiotic that you think's worked, you could send an MSU again a couple of weeks later just to make sure that things have completely resolved.
Yeah.
And if someone's getting recurrent complicated urinary tract infections, you need to do some further investigations. So an ultrasound of the renal tract or an x-ray looking for stones. Or these days, people are often doing just CTs of the abdomen and the pelvis looking for any
structural abnormalities and things that are making you more prone to harboring a focus of infection.
But I think once you've diagnosed someone with a urinary tract infection, you're going to go on and treat them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think you have to kind of go, well, why did they get the infection? Why now? Why today? Why not next week? Why not 3 weeks on Wednesday? Mm. What was it that led to that infection? So I think thinking about some of those reasons, you know, have they got constipated recently? Mm. Are they having difficulties managing their bowel function? Are they getting soiled in feces?
So to decode that for people who aren't so familiar, constipation can cause a bit of urinary retention because the loaded rectum pushes on the bladder neck, and it's in that way that it can contribute to infections.
Yep.
And if you've got new faecal incontinence or diarrhea, then those bugs moving forward.
Go straight in, transit inwards, yeah. Are they well hydrated?
Yeah.
Is the urine super concentrated? Have they got a new diagnosis of diabetes and their urine's become very sugary and, you know, causing infection that way?
Why did they get dehydrated?
Yeah.
If they're dehydrated, was their oral intake limited because they had some mobility issues, and actually you're going a few steps back then to prevent them from having them again in the future?
On the way up here, I was listening to the Two Docs Talk podcast.
Which is not us. Sounds like us.
Yeah. And they were talking about urinary tract infections, and they were talking about the importance of diet to diet changing the acidity of the urine as a potential causative agent, which I thought was quite interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Have a listen.
Yes.
Another thing to look for is atrophic vaginitis, which can make you more prone to urinary tract infections and is reasonably easily treated in principle. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
I'm talking about treatments. Generally, use your local guidelines.
Antibiotics-wise.
But generally, amoxicillin is not going to work. It's very high resistance to that. And the treatment courses are not generally 5 days long for urinary tract infections. They tend to be 3 days for women and 7 days for men.
Mm.
Yeah. The 5 days everyone seems to write down is your pneumonias and that sort of stuff. That tends to be 5 days. Urinary tract infections tend to be 3 or 7, but have a read of your local guidelines.
Yeah. And the reason for the local guidelines is not just us palming you off. It's because there's different bugs in different areas and different resistances in different areas. So you do really need to have your local guidance to hand for what you should do.
And it's important we get it right.
Prophylactic antibiotics probably follows on next. We don't use them really anymore. I think that they are useful for some people. But the evidence that they prevent urine infections isn't really there, is it? It's I think there was a Cochrane review that looked at it and said that it can reduce infections by 0.01 1-5 events per year, but actually they had lots of side effects from those antibiotics. Having said that, some people do really well with it.
Yeah.
And I think that knowing how reviews are, that they're taking lots of different studies, I think it's probably some people get their events reduced and it works really, really well for them. And actually there are a lot of people who it doesn't, but you feel like you're doing something, they feel like you're doing something. It's not necessarily the right thing. So I think a few years ago, sort of 10 years ago, they were used quite a lot.
Yeah. And there's
really
a nice, there is also a nice guideline quality standard on it that, again, I'll put a link to in the show notes to go and have a look at.
One thing I learned recently is that if you are on prophylactic antibiotics and you get admitted to hospital, you should stop them while they're in hospital, because otherwise you expose that antibiotic to all of those hospital bugs.
Mm-hmm.
So you should stop it while you're in hospital and then restart in the community, which is actually quite clever.
Yeah.
And I never thought of it like that before, and it's changed what I do.
I think topical estrogens, topical vaginal estrogens are very useful.
If
people have vaginal atrophy and recurrent UTIs, or even vaginal atrophy and recurrent lower urinary tract symptoms.
Yeah,
actually.
Because it may be from the atrophic vaginitis
rather than
an infection. Urine infection.
They come as a cream or a pessary.
Yeah, and the pessaries need changing every 12 weeks, 3 times.
Yeah, and the creams obviously need some manual dexterity to use. And they can cause some local irritation in up to sort of 20% of people.
Yeah.
But if people get on with it, they work really well.
Yeah.
And they do work nicely.
To think about and have in the back of your mind, and that they can reduce your rate of urinary tract infections if that's the cause of it. Also, it's a treatment that you really have to have capacity to consent to, because it's quite an invasive treatment for someone who doesn't understand what's going on. So for that reason, obvious reasons, we don't use it in our kind of more cognitively impaired patients.
Cranberry juice. Yay or nay, Jo?
Inconclusive.
Inclusive, yeah.
I say it doesn't do any harm.
No. Lemon barley can sometimes help with the pain
dysuria.
It
doesn't. Which is interesting when you were saying about that article you were reading on the way up, or the podcast you were listening to on the way up, talking about that. I wonder whether that might link in, but I think that it does take away the pain. So if getting that kind of fear of going to the toilet and then not drinking because of the pain of a urinary tract infection can then make you dehydrated and make the urinary tract infection kind of worse. That is something that I think works to help maintain oral intake. And that's something that kind of leads on nicely to thinking about where you manage people with urinary tract infections, because urinary tract infections are technically classed as something that should be managed in the community and never in hospital. But actually, we all know that actually it's so much more complicated than just the infection. So thinking about whether you can manage someone in the community, so can they maintain adequate hydration by themselves at home? Are they going to drink? Are they going to...
enough to be able to get up to walk to the kitchen?
Yeah. If they've got a delirium on top with the urinary tract infection, they're going to remember to drink. Are they going to have access to the drink through the mobility and that kind of thing?
Are they going to be able to get to the bathroom or use a commode? And understand to do that and manage to do
and
that.
And if their mobility goes down, whether that's really possible. Could you get them a commode, though, if their mobility is down? Could you get your community OT to come and help with that so they can manage at home just for a temporary period?
And it is often just a temporary period, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the antibiotics are for 3 days, and often any associated delirium settles quite quickly with a urinary tract infection. So often people get better quite swiftly.
Yeah. And thinking about, can they take oral antibiotics? Will they be compliant with them?
Also thinking about catheters as another sort of adjunct to thinking about urinary tract infections.
Yeah.
They certainly increase the risk of infection.
Yeah. So about 8% of bacteremias in hospital
are catheter associated.
Which is terrible.
It's huge, isn't it? And if you've got an infection on the tubing, you're not going to clear it with antibiotics.
It's like having a structural abnormality.
Yes. So you've got to change the catheter.
Yes. So if you diagnose a urinary tract infection in someone with a catheter, you need to change it too. So do that.
And they reduce the natural bladder contractions.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you take the catheter out, you'll run the risk of going into retention when they wouldn't have before. Or sometimes people get overactive bladder type symptoms and bladder irritation.
Yeah.
As a result of the bladder suddenly having to contract again and
can't remember how to do
it. Confused.
So the less you can use catheters, the better. Basically, don't use them unless you really, really have to. And if you do have to, get them out as quickly as you can afterwards. The alternatives, if continence and kind of pressure areas and that kind of thing are an issue, in men, you could think about Convenes. Simple solution.
Cool. So we've talked a little bit about symptoms of urinary tract infections in older adults and some of the contributing factors that make us as more likely to get infections as we get older.
Yep.
Some of the common investigations and how to interpret them. Mm-hmm. I think we've talked about that enough for now. We've talked about how to do a bladder scan. And also, not all lower urinary tract symptoms are due to UTIs. And I'm sure at some point in the future we will have another episode talking through urinary tract symptoms and prostate disease and stuff like that at some point in the future.
So go forth and spread the word of how to diagnose a UTI for real.
And let us know what you think. We can be found on Twitter at @MDT_podcast.
On Facebook.com/MDT podcast.
And via the website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk/MDT. MDT is like a cup of tea each of those times.
The MDT Podcast.
And now it's time for the MD teaser, the catchily titled MDT Item Guessing Game. We'll read a series of increasingly more simple clues about an item that a member of our MDT might use.
Yeah. And I think it's 2-1 to me.
You think it is?
We think it is.
We're on episode 5, so I don't know.
I don't know how that's true. But, well, I think it's because we had a draw.
Did we have,
we did.
Yeah.
So it's your go first.
I have to say I'm very excited about mine.
You're always very excited about your clues, Jo.
Okay. Are you ready?
Yes. No, I'm not.
Let me know when
I am now.
Yep. Okay. First clue.
Yep.
Traditionally, use of this was exclusively by doctors, but not anymore.
Pass.
Second clue. This item featured heavily in the first series of The Wire. Which, that's unfair because I know you haven't watched The Wire. So, in The Wire, the item was used by drug dealers.
Primarily used by... Is it a white coat?
It is not.
No.
The third clue is that it's onomatopoeic.
It's a patella hammer. Hammer, sort of onomatopoeic.
Oh, I see. Okay, I was just thinking... What kind of drug dealers do you know that wear white coats and use patella helmets? Obviously, Surrey is a different place. Okay. Fourth clue. Use is one way.
One way?
One way.
Stethoscope?
No. Again, not many drug dealers.
No.
Drug
I think
dealers
opening safes, maybe. Safes.
Okay.
Right. Maybe.
Yeah, thinking to gang crime. Okay.
Yeah.
Fifth and final clue is that it's commonly black.
I don't know.
It's a bleep. It's onomatopoeic. Bleep. In the 90s, drug dealers used them.
Yeah, did they?
Yeah.
Wasn't that pager?
The same thing.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. They were good clues.
Is that why you didn't get it?
They were good clues.
They
that's
were,
why I didn't
right?
get it. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Good. All right.
Okay.
So, I might have to change my last one because my last clue is quite easy. All right. Okay. So... Your first clue, Jo, for my item is this item is available in a number of different types. And I'm going to give you some examples.
Okay.
You could have the Taylor, the Tromner, or the Buck. Obviously, they're the more rare examples, but, you know.
No, okay, next clue.
No. It can also be used with the commonly performed, and it is common, you just may not know the name, Gendrassic manoeuvre.
No, I don't know what that is.
Your third clue is it is used almost exclusively, but not absolutely exclusively, on the limbs.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is that the first two don't feel like clues. They were just random words. Okay.
The fourth clue is it's mostly used by doctors, but I have seen it used by nurses and physiotherapists in the assessment of patients.
No, I don't know.
Okay. Your last clue is it's used to elicit reflexes.
A tendon hammer?
Yes.
I was going to say that, but then I don't know why I didn't.
You still win.
Oh, yeah, I do, yeah. Still disappointed that it's over that time.
So the Gendrassic manoeuvre is reinforcement when you hold your hands together and pull?
Oh, okay. Yep.
Yeah,
okay.
That's my name. I don't know.
What were the first three again? Taylor?
Taylor, Tromner and Buck. The different types of patella hammer. The Buck is the one that has, it looks like a hammer.
Yeah.
And at the end, you unscrew it, and there's like a little brush in the end for testing light touch sensation. And then there's a little pin at the top end.
Yeah.
And the two heads, one is slightly bigger than the other. So one is for tendon reflexes.
Yeah.
And one is for testing myotonia.
And now it's your turn. So this week's clue is, it can be used twice a day. What do you think it is? Let us know using the hashtag MDteaser on Twitter or on Facebook, or you can email us through our website, www.thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk. And that's it for this episode. In the next episode, we'll be talking about depression in older adults. The MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT podcast is a hearing aid podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.